Good morning. We're having a conversation this morning with Mr. Frank Weltner in Frank and Phyllis Weltner's really beautiful Victorian home in Franklin on Elk Street. It's just a beautiful place. We're very fortunate to be here. And thank you, Frank, for having us. Folks who don't know Frank don't realize that he's had a remarkable life. He is one of those unique individuals who's literally seen the world and seen the world in ways that very few of us could ever hope to. And it's given him a perspective on the world and life that makes him just a great guy to have a conversation with. Just quick background, Mr. Weltner was really a former submariner in the United States Navy, came out as a commander, and then after that career, a lengthy career as a submariner, he then went to sea, working for a commercial firm as the master and captain of several vessels that drilled for oil throughout the world, from the North Sea, clear down across the other side of the globe, down into the South Pacific, off of Southeast Asia and into Indonesia. So Frank has been around, there's no question about it. And we listen to Frank because, among other things, he has these just great stories. Now, before we get into some of these great stories and the life that you've led, I've got to comment, Frank, about this house. This is kind of legendary. When you bought this house did not look, in the interior at any rate, anything like it does today. It was an apartment house, and you brought it back from almost death. That took a lot of doing, and you did most of it, from what I understand. How'd you know how to do all that?
Well, for one thing, after that introduction, I don't know how I can possibly live up to it.
Yeah.
But regarding the house, it at one time did have 9 apartments in it. And when I bought it, it had 6 operating apartments. Mm-hmm. And it had been cleaned up a little bit. And my wife told me that she liked the house and it could be turned into a really nice home again. And I'm accustomed to following instructions. So I needed a hobby because we just moved in from San Diego after being out there about 25 years. And I was planning to retire, and I had no idea what I'd be doing with my time. And I enjoyed woodworking, and I thought this is a terrific playpen.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved in and I started to work it over. And for instance, this room that we're in right now at one time was a full apartment.
Hmm.
So I started in the kitchen, of course. You have to do the kitchen first. One kitchen, one bathroom, and one bedroom is all you need, so that's what we did. And moved throughout the house, restoring it.
It took you how long to do this, Frank?
It's not finished yet. And that was started in January of 88. And the first 2 floors are pretty well done, but practically nothing has been done to the 3rd floor. Just a little bit of cleanup up there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it.
I have to tell you, you probably don't know this, Lois and I, my wife and I, we first met Phyllis when she graciously came out on this wonderful porch you have here in the front, and she spoke to a group of people taking a tour run by the Rotary, Franklin's Rotary, during Applefest, and it was one of those house tours, the walks that they offered at the time, and your wife came out on the porch and she said hello to the world. Everybody was from all over the place at the time. And I seem to recall she actually let us in the house at just a short bit. So became aware of Phyllis before we came aware of you, Frank. But that's your partner in life, so you can't just talk about you without mentioning, of course, your wife.
Well, she put up with me. I might have been out of town because the first 2 or 3 years, well until 91, every now and then I'd go to sea because somebody would give me a phone call that I couldn't turn down, so I'd take off for 1 month or 4 months or whatever. but it was fun.
So you may not have been here at the time. You mentioned that you came back to this area after 25 years in San Diego, and I know you were all over. That was your home, but you personally were all over. Let's get back, let's go into your, first, your earlier life. Were you actually born and raised in Franklin, or whereabouts?
No, I was born in June of 27 in Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh.
And we lived in Girard at that time. And, of course, shortly thereafter, the Depression came in. And my father had a very good job. He was an electrician at one of the larger steel mills. But he contracted tuberculosis, almost died. So he couldn't work in a steel mill environment anymore. And, of course, with the Depression, it was very hard to get any work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lived in various parts of Ohio during the Depression, and occasionally we would go to my father's homestead, my granddad's farm, and eke our way through the Depression. But then we wound up in Butler, Pennsylvania, when I was in the third grade. At that time, my father was working for the Kalamazoo Stove and Furnace Company. He would set up a retail outlet and train some furnace installers and so forth, and then move on to the next assignment,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be Venango County after Butler. But I spent my second year in the third grade in Butler, because when I was young, I refused to learn anything. I enjoyed hunting frogs and turtles and things like that, but school was a total waste of time. But I met my school teacher in the third grade, and it was her very first class. And my very first introduction to a large school like they had in Butler. And she was absolutely beautiful. And not only that, she came off of a farm right outside of Butler, a big dairy farm. And I loved dairy farms. That's what my granddad had. And we got along great.
Mm-hmm.
And some big kid in the class badmouthed her a little bit. So at recess, I pummeled the living daylights out of him. So then that straightened him out.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to stay in after school and clean the blackboard and the erasers.
Oh.
Now, it don't get any better than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I got to spend about 15 or 20 minutes with my new love.
Yes, you know? Yes.
But it was straight A's from then on.
There you go, Frank.
I found out school wasn't all that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we came up here, I went to a school outside of Franklin, the Lincoln School. It was 8 grades all in one room. And that was a nice experience. But and then 1 year of school in Franklin, and we moved right across the 8th Street Bridge, and I spent my sophomore high school year in Cranberry. I knew everything that you could learn then in high school, so I joined the Navy in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it as far as formal education.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't learned anything since.
No, it's been a long time. Maybe you better go back to that grade school in Butler.
Get re-motivated.
Right, once again.
Right.
So, all right, so you went into the Navy in 44, right there towards the end of the Second World War.
Yes.
Up the Great Lakes, I suppose, and then...
No, I went to Sampson, New York.
Oh.
And then I went from Sampson, New York to Norfolk, Virginia, to they had a very large, what they called an outgoing unit, a huge mess hall, and I worked there as a groundskeeper. I had 4-man working party every day.
Mm-hmm.
people were waiting around to get reassigned. And ran into an interesting incident there. On weekends, you would be assigned to, you know, you lived in a barracks with about 100 people, mm-hmm. all in one great dormitory. And on the weekend, if you had the weekend duty, you had to just hang around there. I don't know why, but I had a real good date with a lovely lady over in, probably 17 years old, over in Suffolk, Virginia, mm-hmm. on this one day. But I had friends that would answer muster for me. When they'd come in and call my name, they'd say, here. And I had a backup or two, mm-hmm. in case the one guy wasn't there. So when the master at arms came in and held muster and called my name, three people said, here. So I went to captain's mast. And
I imagine you did.
They threw me in the brig for a while, and it was a Marine Corps ran the Navy brigs. And while I was in there, they jerked me out and sent me to radar school, of all places, a Cavalier Hotel in Virginia Beach.
Is that right?
I shared a really lovely corner room with another young fellow, and we studied radar about 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, until that school was over. I enjoyed that. I found I was very good at it. And then immediately signed to a brand new little APD, a high-speed little tiny destroyer, and went out and depth-charged German submarines and so forth. I only saw one torpedo wake the way from a torpedo being shot at us, went right across our bow.
Right?
And we were in a hard right turn, or I'm sure it would have hit us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I don't know if we ever sank a German submarine or not, but we sure threw a lot of depth charges and hedgehogs and so forth all over them. And we got a couple of oil slicks came up that they would, if they knew what they were doing, they'd pump a little oil out just to make people think they got hit.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's hard to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the name of that APD?
It was the APD Upham.
Upham.
99.
Okay, I was on the Weiss. I think I told you that. That was out on the West Coast.
This was the Upham, and we were in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, when the war was over in Japan,
mm-hmm.
and the whole, so that we put the APD in mothballs down in Florida, Green Cove Springs, Florida, and then I went to another destroyer for a while, and I got discharged from the Navy then. It was on the 19th of June. I remember that because it was the day before my 18th birthday. Hmm. And I'd been in the Navy almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I was out of the Navy then for about a year. And then July of the next year, I rejoined.
And on the Navy, you were an ET there for a while, correct?
When I went back in.
Electronics technician for our audience.
When I went back in the Navy, they sent me to New York and was sort of they were sort of getting ready, I think, for a Korean War or something. And they had specialists, the personnel specialists that gave you a battery of tests and all, try to figure out what you were good for. And they wanted to send me to electronics school, but you had to have a high school diploma or pass what they called an Eddy test, which had a lot of trigonometry in it. And I told this specialist that I didn't have a high school diploma, and he said, well, he'd waiver that if I could pass the test. And I said, well, I don't know how I could possibly pass that test without having any trig. I had a little bit of geometry. So I got assigned to a destroyer And I was on there about 10 days, and I got a set of orders to go to ET school. So I was double wavered.
Yes, right.
And that was an engineering course they had. It lasted 52 weeks, 6 days a week. And it was basically the entire engineering curriculum for electrical engineering and electronic.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had the same textbooks, Dawes and Termins, I believe. Good reading.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Terrific education.
It was very good, and I had two excellent tutors that went through. My two best buddies, we were like a three peas in a pod, and they were very brilliant young men, and they drug me through the whole way.
Yeah.
No problem.
I'm sure you were tough to drag through.
Well, we had a good time.
Yeah. Did they stay in like you did?
One of them stayed in, and he was picked up by Admiral Rickover, and the other one didn't stay in, and he went out and got an education. I believe either GE or Westinghouse picked him up and gave him a college degree and became an engineer. He was very, very brilliant man.
You hung around with the right people, Frank.
Well, I needed all the help I could get. I always did. But
at this time, was this about the time you married Phyllis, or was this a
yes,
little later?
Yes, I married her while I went back to the same destroyer that I left when I was gone 52 weeks, 53 or 4 weeks, about a year, but I wound up right back on the same destroyer. And while I was on there is when I met Phyllis, and up in Oil City, I crashed her girlfriend's birthday party when I came home on leave. But we got married then in 49. And I was on this destroyer, and I'd been on there a couple of, over 2 years. And being married, and I decided I'd go to shore duty. And my enlistment was almost up. And I put in a request for shore duty, and I was turned down by the, I was in the engineering department since I was in electronics. And I was told that I was indisposable, they needed me, they were going to go to Europe or something, and but I was getting out of the Navy if I wanted to, so I couldn't understand that. But I went to the barber shop, and the captain was in there getting a haircut. And he mentioned that he hoped I was going to re-enlist. I didn't know why he was that deep into personnel, but he knew that my enlistment was coming up. And I told him I was going to get out of the Navy because I put in a request for shore duty, and I was turned down. And he said, well, fill out another request and bring it directly to me. And I did. And lo and behold, he wasn't more than 2 weeks, and I had a set of orders to be an instructor at Marquette University. And that's where I went after I went to instructor school for quite a lengthy school. It was very good. And I went to Marquette University, almost went to Marquette, Michigan, and I found out that Marquette University was in Milwaukee by chance.
Yeah.
So I wound up at the right place.
You made the wrong turn by mistake.
Right. It
turned out right. Yeah.
Yeah, everything worked out great. I was there 3 years. Right after I got to Marquette, I had taken the test for E6, which was first class ET, and I was promoted almost by the same time I got there. And I really enjoyed 3 years at Marquette University.
Did you make chief while you were up there, or was it after you left Marquette?
No, it was after I left Marquette. While I was there, and had about 6 months to go, because I wound up teaching an engineering plant, a destroyer plant for the seniors. Mm-hmm. I was a senior instructor's assistant. I did a lot of the field trips and lecturing myself. But the professor of naval science there, a Navy captain, had been a submariner during war. He told the senior instructor that I worked for to send me to OCS, Officer Candidate School. So he came down, sat down beside my desk, and told me that what his assignment was. And I looked him right in the eye and said, "Well, we've got our work cut out for us." And he said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Well, you know that you have to have the equivalent of 2 years of college to go to OCS. That's the way it was then." And he said, "Yeah, I'm aware of that, but I think we can do that." And I said, "But I only have 2 years of high school." Mm-hmm. So he said, "Well, you're right." But USAFE, which was the organization for educating military personnel, their headquarters was in Madison, Wisconsin. So he called Madison, and we would go up there and filled out all the papers, get all the tests with an understanding that they would be proctored, and we would hand deliver them, which we did. So that's how I got my high school diploma and picked up the 1 year college equivalent tests, brought them back to, they were proctored, and we took them back to Madison and passed all those right there on the spot, and brought the second year college exams back and took them, and proctors were getting a little bit scarce, so the captain agreed to proctor a couple exams. And one of them was fine arts. And I'm looking at these pictures and things, and I said, "Well, I don't know anything about fine arts." And I pointed to a picture of Blue Boy, and I said, "Now that's a picture of Blue Boy, but I can't remember who the artist was." And he had about five likely people to pick from. And he said, "Well, I can't understand why you need to know anything about fine arts." He says, "I know you could learn how to run a cruiser." So he came over, and we went through that test line item by line item. And between the two of us, we thoroughly flunked it.
Neither one of you knew a thing about my arts.
Apparently not. I didn't know Gothic architecture from Roman architecture. Mm-hmm. Neither did he. But we took those exams back, and I failed that. And time was running out. And he asked me if I'd like to go to submarine school, and I said, "I sure would." And he said, "Well, I'll send you. You can go to submarine school, and you can get a commission later on." And but by that time, I had a set of orders from Bupers because they needed an electronic technician with my background on the command ship over in the Pacific. So I went to that ship, and it was a huge thing, and hundreds and hundreds of radio receivers and transmitters and radars and monitoring equipment and whatever. And I had about 32 electronic technicians working for me, but this captain told me when I left that the submarine force would have me out of there in 6 months. And he was right. In 6 months, I had a set of orders to go to submarine school. So that's how I wound up going to submarine school.
Which coast East Coast, West Coast?
The submarine school or the ship?
The submarine school.
Well, that's in New London, Connecticut.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, that's the capital of the submarine world.
Right.
Yeah, we went to New London, and getting out of Japan was interesting. You want that story?
Yeah, sure.
Well, they sent me up to Tokyo, and we're up there in Tokyo, and we're going to take a military flight to California, and there's old twin constellations, you know.
Yes.
They had a double tail on them.
Yeah, I've flown on a few.
And so we got on there, and most of the passengers were Air Force people. Mm-hmm. And I sat right behind an old sergeant, probably a lot younger than I am today, but he seemed like an old guy to me, and he had a young private in tow. And so we're starting to take off, and we got up in the air. And this private said, "Well, how long do you think it'll be before we get to Hawaii?" And the sergeant said, "We're not going to Hawaii." He said, "Well, what do you, I thought we were." He said, "Well," he said, "we're not going to go anywhere." He said, "The pilot will get on a horn here in a minute and tell us we're going back to Japan."
Hmm.
And sure enough, in about 3 or 4 minutes, we turned around and went back to the airport in Tokyo. And they worked on it for an hour or two. Took off again. We're all in our same seats. And the private said, "Well, how are we doing?" And the sergeant was about asleep, and he rolled his head over and he said, "We're good for about a half an hour at the most." And sure enough, about probably 15 minutes, we turned around and went back.
Uh-huh.
And so we landed, and this sergeant got up, and he said, "Well, boys, if we're going to get out of Japan, we're going to have to fix this damn thing ourselves." And they did.
Uh-huh.
And I slept all night long on a bench in the Tokyo airport, and they came around and woke me up and said, "We're ready to go."
Uh-huh.
So we went to Midway Island. And on the way into Midway, the private and the sergeant were talking, and the sergeant assured this private that if they had any sense at all, they would bury that plane on the Midway Island. So it took me about 2 days. I finally got a ride out of there on an old DC-9 that had been, or DC-8 or 9. Hmm. It had been converted to for hauling wounded personnel. It had stretchers installed. Mm-hmm. So I sat in a stretcher from Midway to Moffett Field in California. And I caught a B-24 bomber. It had a nose cone for the machine gunner. And I sat in the nose cone. It was a good, beautiful view.
Mm.
And they had a general up there flying as a co-pilot. Never been on one. But I could listen in to all the conversations, and went down to Riverside, California, up inland from San Diego, and hitchhiked down to San Diego. All I had to do was buy a private enough gasoline to get down there to see his girlfriend and get back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
I was only about 2 or 3 days late. Phyllis didn't know where I was or how I was getting there or anything, and she'd moved, the movers had already moved her out. She was staying with a neighbor. But everything worked out great.
That's good. That's great.
So her and the two children, and away we went to
London.
Checked into New London, Connecticut.
Beginning your time as a submariner.
Right.
And it impacted everything you did after that.
More or less. Well, I just sort of fell into all these little deals, but so I enjoyed submarine school, and there was one captain from Marquette days that wanted me down in Key West, Florida, because he wound up as a squadron commander. And I even got a letter from him. I ran into it just the other day. And he was looking forward to seeing me. But the Navy, in their wisdom, sent me to Norfolk, Virginia, because they had a radar picket submarine that was 30 foot longer than the normal fleet submarines, because they had added a 30 foot section for electronic equipment. So I was assigned to that. And not too long after, we were getting geared up to make a little trip up north of, this was during the Cold War, you know.
Yeah.
And we did a little spook maneuver up to north of Russia. Mm-hmm. We played along the way a little bit. We went up and went through the English Channel, and took the Kiel Canal, I think more or less for fun than anything else, and then went into Copenhagen, hung around there for a while, and then we went up to Oslo, Norway, had a really good time in Oslo, and we came out of that fjord and looped right up around Norway up into the Barents Sea. Mm-hmm. And we had two communication technicians on board, and their assignment was to monitor all the telemetry they could gather and any radio conversations or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they were very busy, and there were some fishing boats up there. And there was a large ship that was pretending to be a mothership for the fishing fleet, but they had an array of antennas on board. This was a Russian ship, all these Russian trawlers and so forth. And I happened to be up on the bridge. I liked to get up and get out in the fresh air as much as I could. And I was standing on lookout duty, and there was a big black belch of smoke came out of that thing, and I could tell it was getting underway, and it did. And it was coming straight at us as hard as it could. And we had a division commander on board. I couldn't believe what the captain said. He said, "What do you think I should do?" And the division commander said, "You either torpedo him or you die."
To die.
The diving alarm went off. So we cleared the bridge and dove, and that thing come roaring right over top.
Is that right?
Yeah, looked to me like he had an icebreaker bow, and he didn't care. They would have squashed us if they could have. Mm-hmm. So we dove and messed around a little bit longer and left. But I think we were probably up there at least a week doing whatever we could. And went back to the States, and we were back there for a while. And one of the things that an officer has to do on a submarine to be advanced to exec and then captain is he has to demonstrate acquiring a target and successfully putting all the proper inputs into a torpedo data computer, which is an antique analog computer, and successfully firing an exercise torpedo at a legitimate target, mm-hmm. which would be another submarine cooperating. Mm-hmm. And this was taking place off of somewhere up off of New England, in that area. And I used to hang around with the sonarman a lot, because that was interesting, particularly on something like this. So I'm basically leaning over his shoulder, and I repaired those things anyhow, so it was my job. And he was setting up his run, and we acquired the target submarine at a bearing of approximately 050, 050, it was to the east of us. Mm-hmm. And he's giving the information to the conning tower, the bearing and so forth. And then we got another unidentified contact to the north, probably around 020. He reported that, and he was immediately informed that that was probably a side lobe or, you know, some sort of interference, and not to worry about it because there wasn't any other submarines in the area. So he was requested to give a turn count. Now that's the speed of the target's propellers to give the conning officer an indication of the speed. Mm-hmm. And we were giving him a bearing drift to the right, so he knew the target was probably going some to 180 or in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. As far as the course. But he wanted the speed, so he gave him the turn count on the targets that we were tracking, and he also gave him a different turn count on the side lobe, and he got a sharp response from the conning tower on that. But I knew that there was another target there, and the sonarman did too. Mm-hmm. He was definitely sure. They were going at two different speeds, and at any rate, all the information went into the torpedo data computer, and that information was fed into the torpedo in the forward torpedo room, and they fired the exercise torpedo. And a sonarman's response when you fire a torpedo is he's to keep the conning tower informed on the behavior of the torpedo. And the proper response would be, or the favorable response is, the torpedo is running hot, straight, and normal, mm-hmm. Which he gave that report. Because that exercise torpedo was energized and going straight towards the target where it was supposed to, probably leading it by a few degrees so it would hit it. And he also reported right after that that the side lobe had fired a torpedo, and his torpedo was running hot, straight, and normal directly towards us. Mm-hmm. So the conning officer was immediately released by the captain who got on the line, and he said, Joe, are you sure our torpedo is running hot, straight, and normal to the target? And he said, yes, I am, Captain, and I'm sure that the torpedo that unidentified contact fired is running hot, straight, and normal directly towards us. And we could feel the submarine picking up a little bit of speed. So the captain, at this time, was giving that torpedo a broadside shot. Those submarines were 330 feet long, the one we were on. Mm-hmm. A little over 330 feet long. So he brought that submarine around directly to the left so that he would give it a bow-on shot, which was giving it now a 26-foot target instead of a 330-foot target. Mm-hmm. And we no more than got that torpedo swung around, and that torpedo, the unidentified contact fired at us, came roaring down the side, sounding like a freight train. And it was absolutely unbelievably loud.
Wow.
Wow. It definitely broke the monotony, it was throughout the submarine. Yeah. And so of course we surfaced and made all sorts of communication and all that good stuff. And when we pulled into home port, there was our engine man, his name was Chief Holderfield. He had his bags packed, and he said, enough is enough. He said he'd been shot at during the war, World War II, mm-hmm. and this peacetime being torpedoed, it wasn't in his, he wasn't going to put up with it. Mm-hmm. So he left, and he retired. And we're going to have a secretary answer the phone in the purple room, straight ahead.
This is a call from the Pentagon telling you to shut up, Frank. They know what you're saying. This never made it in the news, did it?
No, it didn't. But Chief Holderfield retired. Uh-huh. And so that was very interesting. But
I have to think that the torpedo fired by the Soviet sub was
probably a warhead.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they were ever able to find it and recover it or not.
What in the world?
But there was a lot of
confrontation out there that people were not aware of during the Cold War.
Some of the stuff we did during the I don't know if you'll ever know, because it was pretty hairy.
Yeah.
I mean, even the little bit that I did, and I've heard some really good stories. But now that one I just told you is an absolute fact, and it happened.
About what year would that have been? 55 or so?
Probably 55, 56.
Mm-hmm. That Cold War era, particularly in the 50s, I think it somewhat after the Cuban Missile Crisis, things started to tone down because it just was getting out of hand. But that was a rough time. People don't know, particularly at sea. The Navy ran into it quite a bit.
Yeah, I was on a submarine down there when they were bringing the missiles into Cuba. Uh-huh. And they informed this one cargo ship to turn around and go back, not to go in. And I don't know whether we would have actually torpedoed them or not. But we were there and we had a...
And you were ready.
We were loaded for bear. Mm-hmm. And they turned around and went back.
Rough times.
But, well, shortly after that, I was trying to figure out whether I wanted to stay in the Navy again or get out. And I was having a bad time with the captain, which I couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, why all of a sudden did he hate my guts, you know, so... So I was out on the pier one day, and back in those days, Bell Labs in New Jersey was a big engineering outfit for electronics. And this engineer strolled over. I'd worked with him a little bit in the shipyard. And he said, Frank, he said, I'm not allowed to recruit personnel on active duty. He says, but I understand you're up for reenlistment before too long. Now, how he found this out, I don't know. And I said, oh, that's true. He says, well, he says, when you're out, he says, and you're interested, he said, I've got a contract in my desk that you can't turn down. So I figured, well, this is interesting. So the next day, the squadron personnel officer, I ran into him, and I knew who he was, but I had no idea how he knew who I was. But he called me over and wanted to know if I was going to re-enlist. And I told him I really hadn't made up my mind. And he said, well, what's wrong? I said, well, I'm a little tired of that submarine I'm on now. I said, maybe I might go somewhere else. And he said, what submarine would you like? And I knew some guys on the Cobbler, and the captain on there was fantastic, and it was really a good submarine. And I said, well, I might be interested in the Cobbler. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe it. In 2 days, I had a set of orders for the Cobbler.
Is that right?
Yeah. Wow. Right on like that. Uh-huh. So I'm talking to my wife's good girlfriend. She was a bank teller. And she was a very interesting young lady. She had to get rid of her husband because he had a mental problem. But anyhow, that's a long story. But she was dating the captain on the Redfin. That was a submarine I was on when it was. And She was also interested in the engineering officer. But on this one date, the last date she had with the captain, I guess she told him that, now this is her story, that she wasn't going to date him anymore.
Uh-huh.
And this is weird now. And he wanted to know why. And she said, well, if you were half the man that Frank Weltner is, I'd love to go out with you. And I said, what on earth did you say that for? She says, well, that's what came into my mind. That was a kiss of death.
Yeah, oh, sure.
So anyhow, I wound up on the Cobbler. I had a great time on there.
Uh-huh.
And shortly after I was on there, we were headed for...
And let's just go back one second. That's why you were not getting along with the CO of the Redfit at that
right,
time.
Right, I wasn't getting along with him.
Just to make that point.
So I got off the Redfin because more or less a threat of leaving the Navy.
Right.
And they gave me whatever I wanted.
Right.
And so I couldn't complain too much because I didn't really want to go anyhow. And I had a lot of fun on the Cobbler.
Mm-hmm.
And we were headed for San Juan, Puerto Rico. And I notified while we were underway that I had made chief. I'd been promoted to chief. Well, on a submarine, all the chiefs on there, they have a big initiation party for the new chief. And one of the things they were supposed to do was throw him over the side. And there was also an all-nav order came out, all-Navy order that came out that nobody was to be thrown over the side, particularly on a submarine, because every now and then they beat their head on the hull on the way down, and they have to fish them out. But so that was, captain said that absolutely weren't allowed to do that. He'd love to see it, but he'd...
They won't throw you over.
So don't throw him over.
Uh-huh.
So they were going to do something else. So we pulled into San Juan, Puerto Rico, tied up alongside the quay wall, and there was a couple of people, two couples, looking like they might be Americans or Europeans, and they were really looking the submarine over. And the chief of the boat on there was a sharp guy. So he went out and was talking to them. And they were putting the brow over and so forth. And they were two couples that worked for Alice Chalmers, I believe.
Mm.
One of the farm machinery.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it was Alice Chalmers. And he invited them aboard. And it was about 11:30. And so him and I and a couple of other chiefs and so forth talked to them. And the chief of the boat and I gave him a complete tour of the submarine. And then it was time for lunch, and we fed them lunch. And so they invited all the chiefs on the boat to come over to the Creeb Hilton Hotel for dinner on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the chief of the boat said, we can't do that because we're going to have an initiation for Chief Weltner tonight. And so it's going to be a big party. And so they talked about it. Well, what do you do? And this and that, and one thing or another. And they said, well, we want to find something. We're going to throw him off the pier or into a swimming pool or something. He said, we haven't made up our mind. So they couldn't understand why they couldn't have an initiation party at the Creeb Hill,
mm-hmm.
which we did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a dandy. And they had a real nice swimming pool there, and it's sort of in the center of a great big courtyard, and there were balconies around, you know, people were looking down, and tables all around, and I mean, there were a lot of people there, but they drug me down there to the swimming pool, and four of these chiefs, one on each leg and one on each arm, proceeded to swing me back and forth in a uniform, wallet and all, right into that swimming pool. and there were quite a few spectators that didn't appreciate it at all, and they were going to throw the other chiefs in. So a lot of fast talking was going on, and they finally, so they got out of being thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over, and taxi cab wouldn't pick me up because
soaking wet.
So they had me hide behind a pillar while they hailed a cab down. And
mm-hmm.
opened the door and ushered me in. So I went down and changed clothes. This was about midnight. Came back, joined the party. But that was on Ellis Chalmers, the whole thing. And we were invited back. I spent many two or three days over there with those people, and so did some of the other chiefs. And we got Christmas cards from them for years.
That's great.
It was a good experience.
Now, we kind of have to move on here.
Okay.
I don't know how much more time you spent as a submariner. Was it a number of years or a relatively short time?
No, I left that submarine and went to an instructor school at Naval Schools Command in Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for... This was in 50... When 59 rolled around, there were two chief electronic technicians at this radio school, keeping all the transmitters and everything. And we also taught basic electronics to the radio men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the E89 program came out. And that was two additional pay grades. The chief was E7, and E8 and E9 was invented for the military,
mm-hmm.
Sergeants and so forth. So, and we didn't get the two ETs, myself and the other one, we were sort of frowned on by the radio men, because we didn't pay any attention to them. And we didn't think that we would be recommended for E8 or E9. And the other ET, his name was Baker, he had used to be a personnelman. And he said, I know how we can force them into recommending us for at least E8. I said, how's that? He said, we'll trick them into recommending us to take the LDO exam. That's mm-hmm. for... to be promoted to ensign.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I said, well, okay, we'll do that. So he went down and he's talking to them and about recommending, because he knew that it looked good for the command if you recommend all these people for take the ensign exam. So they said, oh, sure, but you'll have to do all the paperwork. Well, this was right down his alley. I mean, he could type as fast as any secretary I ever ran into, and he knew the books, personnel books. So he did all the paperwork, and he's over there on a typewriter working like mad, filling these papers out. I'm working on a transmitter trying to get it to work, and it was a bench job. And he's asking me questions so he can fill out my papers. And he said, I'm not too interested in it. He said, what are your hobbies? And I said, I like woodworking and automobile repair and antique cars. And I said, I think I said broad jumping or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, I got that. Bridge, golf, and tennis. So he filled... He filled out all
the appropriate hobbies.
He did all the paperwork.
Right.
And there was probably 140 or so people in the schools command at Norfolk. It's a big operation.
Hmm.
All these different schools. Took the LDO exam. And I believe that year there were only 5 picked up. Both of us. The ET that filled out the papers,
right?
And myself,
yeah, right.
And then a friend of mine that worked as a teletype repairman at the teletype school.
Mm-hmm.
We were real good friends. We shot pistols together.
You knew probably all of them. Now, people don't realize, if you haven't been in the service, I know this, that come up as a LDO Mustang, we called them Mustangs.
That's right.
It was considerable. It was quite an achievement. This was a career route in the service that only the very best people ever got into. I know that as a fact because I worked with them when I was in the Navy, and it's a testimony to the quality individual that you were, and that you were recognized as such. I would like to kind of get to the point where you leave the Navy, and then because of your experience as in the submarines, semi-submersibles, submersibles, those sorts of things, you end up at Global Marine. I know we're jumping ahead a decade or so, but you end up at Global Marine, and you end up the master, and it's called commander, of several of their vessels, some of the largest, most expensive ships and vessels that ever went to sea, ever made by man.
And, that's right.
And you were the master of those vessels. So let's kind of talk a little bit about that, because I want people to realize that all that background in your life led to another experience. It had to do, of course, with oil. Ultimately, that's who was paying the bill for these very expensive ships. So why don't we just, because we only have about 7 or 8 minutes here left, let's just kind of get into that and let people know about that part of your life.
Well, I was commissioned in June, I guess June the 2nd, but I was never recommended for E8.
But you missed out on that.
Right. And so I had quite an interesting career in the submarines as an officer. I got qualified as an officer in submarines. Mm-hmm. And went, and I was a division engineer for submarines and at Submarine Flotilla 1 in San Diego. And I did a couple of I was also the special projects officer there. I did a couple of very interesting special projects for them. I designed a communication system, and I did a torpedo evaluation. I picked the crew and took the submarine to sea, and had all the people get off, and we had to build it up to top speed for the chute, which meant that the two men I had on board with me and the three of us departed in a UDT boat while the submarine was going about 15 mile an hour.
No longer manned, of course.
No, yeah, you know, I had all the people had been taken off. And that turned out very well. And then I got into computerized warfare up at NEL, Naval Electronics Laboratory, and worked on those projects. And I transferred to the Compass Island, which was attached to the scientific lab at Brooklyn, New York.
That's a ship now.
That was a large converted merchant ship. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I can talk about that I did there was development of GPS.
Yes.
So I had a civilian engineer and several electronic technicians working for me while we were developing that. And that was an interesting project. And then
all these GPS units these people carry around today in their pocket, you guys were the early research people.
The one I worked on was about the size of a refrigerator.
Yeah.
But it didn't necessarily have to be that big, but it was easy to work with and change and so forth. So it was just the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to San Diego and worked designing combat information centers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I left the Navy. And while I was designing and installing these installations at the laboratory up there, I had a young engineer work because we were short of engineers, and he was rented from Global Marine Engineering, and he used to bring me drawings, and I can remember one. He said, "Is there anything wrong with this blueprint?" And I took one look at it in about five seconds. I said, "I don't see an analog to digital converter in there." And he said, "There isn't." And I said, "Well, that's what's wrong."
Yeah, right.
And so, but he was amazed that I picked that up so quick.
Yeah.
And, but later on, I was looking for a job when I left the Navy, and I called him to ask him a question for another man that was looking for a job, and he wanted to know what I was doing, and I said, "I'm looking for a job." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, hang on a minute." And I thought he had to answer a phone or somebody's question. But the next thing I knew, this guy says, "My name's Maury Levovitz. I'm the Vice President for Engineering for Global Marine." He said, "If you're looking for a job, I want to talk to you." So I went over and haggled with him for a while, and I went to work for Global Marine Engineering. And I got the job I wanted. It was very nice. I would run around all over the world practically and inspecting ships that had a problem or whatever, and figuring out what they needed to do in the shipyards, and then making my report out in about a week and going back to something else. But then they gave me a job.
Frank, you, for a short time there, had, you owned a wood working company.
Yeah.
And it required some desk time that neither you or your partner really wanted to put in.
That's right.
So it was time for a career change.
Yeah.
Why don't you explain how that happened?
Although I enjoyed working with all the oak and walnut that we used, I just sold my third of the company back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Phyllis decided that I probably should do something that I enjoyed doing. And she wanted to know if I ever did anything that I enjoyed doing. And I had to get her to clarify that, whether it was while I was earning money or whether I was recreating. And she said, "Oh, you know what I'm talking about."
Mm-hmm.
And I told her I enjoyed watching the sunrise in the morning on a 4-to-8 watch and the sunset in the evening on a 4-to-8 watch.
At sea.
And she said, "Well, why don't you go run a ship somewhere?" So I went down to the Coast Guard station in San Diego and talked to the warrant officer down there at the exam center, and he told me that that's great. If you'd have been here a week later, I wouldn't be able to count your Navy time.
Hmm.
So he said, "But you're under the curtain if we do the paperwork right now." Mm-hmm. So we did, and they ran a scan through the BUPERS and all the records and so forth, and all my sea time and what I did and so forth, and they informed me that I could set as either a second deck officer and a third engineer, or I could set as a second engineer and a third deck officer. So I said I wasn't interested in the diesel engines anymore. So I was set up to take the second mate test.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought I could do with relative ease.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out from a gentleman that ran a school up in San Francisco who was a master mariner, and he told me the only way to find out what I needed to know was take the test. So I took that test, which the test was 3 days, 3.5 days actually. Two to 3 hours in the morning and 2 to 3 hours in the afternoon for 3.5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And half of that, anything that had to do with navigation or coastal piloting, had to be 90% or better to pass. And so they really weeded me out pretty quick. And after, and there was all kinds of things. You had to have a little bit of international law and so forth, and international rules of the road. And you had to read a flashing light and interpret what in the international signal book what that meant and so forth. And I often wondered what those midshipmen did for 4 years at the
academy,
at the academies, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Maine Maritime and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out, and then, so I thought, well, maybe I can do this in six months. But it took me. It took me almost a year before I learned enough. Celestial navigation was a real bugger. There's a lot of trigonometry involved, and of course I learned that when I was going to ET school. So I finally got my second deck officer's license and a list of half a dozen shipping places in L.A. to go visit. And the first off-ramp I came to took me right into the Global Marine House. I went in there, and I'd learned from how to get a job. And I went in and talked to the receptionist, and I told her who I wanted to see, who was their VP for personnel. And she said, do you have an appointment? And I said, not exactly. He told me to come and see him. So she handed me an application to fill out. She said, well, you fill this application out, and if we can use you, we'll call you for an interview. And I said, you don't seem to understand. I came here to see Mike Mellon,
mm-hmm.
who was the VP for personnel. I said, he told me to come to see him when I got my mate's license. And I'm here, and I'm going to see him. She said, well, you can't see him. And I said, why not? She said, well, he's on vacation. And I said, well, I intend to see whoever he left in charge. And she was really ticked off, and she stomped off. Pretty soon she came back and said, Mr. Hansen will talk to you when he can.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, thank you. And I went over and sat down and read about one paragraph in an offshore magazine,
mm-hmm.
and she came in and said he'd see me. Now, Global Marine is a worldwide oil exploration company. So I went in and talked to him for a few minutes, and he called her in and said, I want you to bring me a blank two-year contract. And so she ran off and got it. We haggled around a while, and she said, he wanted me to leave that day and go to Savannah, Georgia, and pick up a ship. So she came in and with a contract, and he told her to call Dr. So-and-so because I had to get a physical immediately. So we figured out what I was going to make and so forth, and he wanted me to leave and that day, and I said, well, I have to get a sextant.
Yeah.
He said, you have to have a sextant. I said, yeah, I can't go to sea without a sextant as a navigator. And he said, why not? And I said, well, does a cowboy need a saddle?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all right, can you leave San Diego tomorrow morning? And I said, yeah, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out to get the cab to go to the doctor. And the secretary, or the receptionist, said, I guess this is your lucky day. I says, I'll know a lot more about that in about a week.
Yeah.
And she says, but I hate to do this, but you really do have to fill out this application.
Uh-huh.
And I said, all right. And so I went over it, and I filled out next of kin and address and phone numbers and everything that I felt that she absolutely had to have. And I gave it back to her, and I said, is this all you need? And she looked at it, and she said, yes, that's it. So I got the physical, and I went to Savannah, Georgia, and I met the people, and it was really unbelievable to be able to go to sea with a bunch of characters like that. They had a contract with USGS to drill core samples all the way from Florida up to Maine. And they had USGS personnel on board.
That's geological, sir.
Geological out of Woods Hole, Mass.
Right.
And apparently there were four girls, or women, and four men, and they worked the laboratory, checking the samples out and slicing them up and keeping half of them in a refrigerator. But it appeared to me that they had women from Alaska and the Midwest and Florida, and they'd be on there for 2 weeks and they'd leave. And they appeared to be the favorites of whoever was in charge of one place or another. And the one gal on there was from Woods Hole. I knew that she could stay on there as long as she wanted, because the director of that project, Dr. Hathaway, I think his name was, he thought she was wonderful. He really was. She was very interesting. But anyhow, when that was over, I took the ship with the captain. We went back down to some port in Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi. And then later on, I was called to several other ships to be the navigator. And then they were going to commission a huge new drill ship, the Glomar Pacific. And they put me on that. And I was on that ship for approximately 7 years. Four of those years, I was master. Mm-hmm. As soon as they found out that I'd passed the master's exam, and they got it, were informed by the Coast Guard before I even knew it. And I was on vacation here in Franklin at the time, visiting my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And they called me, the West Coast and Pacific manager called me and wanted to see me at the airport as soon as I could get there. I told him, yeah, I could do that. And he said, well, I got a ticket for you at the Franklin Airport right now.
These folks didn't fool around, did they?
So I met Leon Blurton at the airport, uh-huh, Long Beach, and he took me out to lunch, and we enjoyed ourselves and chit-chatted and jumped on a helicopter and went out to the Glomar Pacific, where I relieved the captain on the Glomar Pacific. And they transferred him to the Glomar Atlantic. And that made the captain, or the manager of the Glomar Atlantic, mad, because he had planned on me being the captain of the Glomar Atlantic. he had talked to me about that earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I told him, if I ever passed the test, I wouldn't care.
Right.
But, hey, his boss had me on something else. So I stayed on there until... And we drilled oil wells in the Santa Barbara Channel and off of Vandenberg Air Force Base and through the Panama Canal up to the off of
North Sea.
No, off of the New Jersey in the Baltimore Channel, and we drilled a real deep top secret well there.
You don't hear much about that.
We drilled that for Exxon. Mm-hmm. See, Exxon had a 5-year contract on that ship,
mm-hmm,
and when that 5 years was up, they extended it for another 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, we were making about $75,000 a day on that contract,
mm-hmm,
and that wasn't net; that was gross. But it was very interesting, and the technology was terrific. And that ship was about a little over 450 feet long, 72 feet wide, and the derrick itself was 140 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just barely get under the Golden Gate Bridge. You had to go in low tide,
yeah,
right in the center. The it was a good tour duty, and I was in my son-in-law wound up on that ship just by a fluke as a chief engineer, and he was complaining down there in the Gulf of Mexico one day that one of his men got promoted finally to chief engineer, and they sent him to the North Sea. Now, that's foreign duty, you make more money. And he was really upset to think that they would send one of his people and not him to the North Sea.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, I said, listen, if I was in personnel and I had a chief engineer like you that was very popular, I wouldn't want to make him mad or anything by sending him off to the foreign job. When he's happy, he's all get out living right outside of Yosemite Park in California. I said, I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I said, if you want to go to the North Sea, you got to ask them. And he said, I don't think that's the way they work. I said, there's the phone, buddy.
Pick it up.
Or shut up. Right. He picked it up, and he called him, and he talked, and he talked, and he talked. Finally, he hung it up, looked at me with a bewildered expression on his face, and said, I'm going to the North Sea. And he was gone maybe a month, and I got a set of orders to the North Sea. Because my friend it used to cover the Pacific, he was promoted to go to up to Aberdeen and take the North Sea and all of Africa, which was a pretty big petroleum-producing operation.
Oh, wow.
So they drug me over there. I went initially to Pori, Finland, where they were building three Arctic-class semi-submersibles. They had already built one, and I went and I was made captain of the Arctic 2, and it was still under final, they were finishing up the construction, and I was getting a lay of the land and getting to know everybody. I was there about 2 weeks, and I was called in off the ship, and the manager told me that Exxon had a fit, and I had to go back to Glomar Pacific. So I packed up my bags and went back to Glomar Pacific. And I told and this was the vice president of the whole geology organization of Exxon. But his superintendent on the ship was a really gentleman person. They were very competent and everything. I liked him very well. And I told Junior Westbrook that I didn't mind coming back because of the hurricane season was just starting to brew. I said, I can understand his concern. I'm surprised that he pays that much attention, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a credit to him.
Yes.
And I said that when this hurricane season's over, I said, Global Marine's not going to pick up the extra $1,500 that I'm missing out on. And I said, I don't think Exxon is willing to do that either. But I would like to make a little more money.
Huh. Yeah.
And he said, I understand that. As soon as that hurricane season was over, I was off to the North Sea and took command of a ship over there, one of the Arctic class semi-submersibles. They put me on the one, the Glomar Arctic One.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to take Phyllis over there, but she didn't want to go. And so I got off the ship and was heading back to San Diego. And Leon Blurton, the area manager, he said, I want to take you out to my house and show you my house. And he had a really nice house there in Aberdeen. He said, we're going on vacation for a couple of months back to the States to take care of some things. He says, I want you to bring Phyllis over here. I want you and Phyllis to live in this house until we get back.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we're going to leave in about a month.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'll have her here.
There you go.
So that was how I got Phyllis out of San Diego.
Yeah. And you got it at Aberdeen, Scotland. This is
we went to Aberdeen, Scotland.
Yes.
And we lived there, and he let the office know to find me a place to live. So we, when Leon got back and settled in, Phyllis and I had to go out and live in this cheap house that they arranged for us. She could be washing dishes and looking out her kitchen window right at this big, beautiful golf course.
With rock
laying. Right on the golf
course. It was really rough.
Really nice place.
That's Aberdeen, Scotland at that. Think about it.
But we enjoyed Scotland. We were there about 3 months or more, and it dawned on us if we were going to be in British waters or British property for more than 6 months out of a year, we had to pay income tax. And my income bracket would be about 60% of my income tax I'd have to pay to the
British government.
So we went down to Europe and bought a European car, and we were driving that thing around and thinking about going down there and maybe Brussels, Belgium. That's where we bought the car. Mm-hmm. And I knew a guy in Brussels. And then there were some people telling me I should go to Spain. But I was doing an inspection on the ship one day, and I saw a brochure for Chopernow, Austria, up in the Alps. And that's where the rig mechanic that took care of the cranes and the air compressors and stuff, he lived there. So I asked him, I didn't know what side of the Iron Curtain it was on, because this one was still the Iron Curtain days. Mm-hmm. He said there was no reason whatsoever that I could live there all I wanted, just no problem. I said, where could I live? And he said, I'll call my mother. She has a flat on the second floor of her house that she rents out to hikers and skiers and so forth. So he called her, and she said, yeah, they'd put me up. So then that was in Mellau, Austria. Now the German electrician who showed me the brochure to start with, he told me that Victor's mother's house was even, her home was even better. And that was, Mellau was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And he told me that once I got to a certain city, just go up between the mountains, because only one road, and it goes right to Mellau. So Phyllis and I went over there and found this place, and it was beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. And Victor's parents were wonderful people. So we stayed there a couple of years. And as luck would have it, now I just have one luck after another, I moved the rig to the Irish Sea. So I'm out of British waters. I'm out of Great Britain, or out of Scotland. And I was only there about 5.5 months.
Is that right?
And the way they, in Austria, as it turned out, I didn't even ask, but the way they work is if you work in Austria, you have to pay Austrian income tax, or if you work in any country bordering Austria, you have to pay income tax. But if you work elsewhere, like China or the North Sea, they're glad to have you come back and spend your money. So no income tax whatsoever.
Right.
So that worked out great.
Sure.
So we're drilling away one day out there, and right off of, in fairly shallow water, about 300 feet, off of Aberdeen. And we had a blowout. Now, a kick is when you get a blast of oil, and because your mud weight isn't right or whatever, and the gas pressure is higher than you anticipated. Mm-hmm. Or you could lose some of your mud and because it was lower than you expected, but you get a big blast of oil and gas come up. And that's controlled with a blowout preventer. Mm-hmm. But But we had a blowout. I mean, a full-blown blowout. And one of the tool pushers went to work on the blowout preventer because it wasn't operating properly from the control station. There are a couple, and they're probably because, well, the company man has one, and he was trying to close the blowout preventer. The driller was trying to close from his station, and it's not doing anything.
No, it's interfering.
So the senior tool pusher went down to the BOP control room, and he cut everybody off, and he's operating it on his own down there. And the other tool pusher called the Phillips. We were drilling for Phillips. He called the Phillips man in Aberdeen and told him that we had a blowout. And he starts giving him a lecture on the difference between a kick and a blowout. And so the tool pusher cut him off, and he said, "What the hell do you call it when you've got oil and gas flying over the crown block and the top of the derrick?"
Right.
So that ended that lecture.
And
he told them to get a helicopter out there because they had such a blast of oil and mud and shale and stuff come into the shale shaker room that it blew two men right out the back entrance of this shale shaker room and down those iron steps.
Yeah.
And they were really beat up bad.
Yeah.
And they put them in the fire in the lifeboat. And the company man came in to the bridge, and now this is a fact, and he had a park on, you know, this was in probably February, early March.
Cool.
And he come in there with his arms stretched out, total panic, waving them around, and he was covered with mud, all over, park and all, and the only thing I could see that wasn't chocolate colored was his eyeballs, and he's hollering, "Get us out of here, Cap. Get her on our way." And, you know, these things had two powerful screws. You could go whenever you wanted.
Right.
But you'd have to dump the chains.
Right.
So he wants me to get underway. And then he went down and got in the lifeboat. And that's why the tool pusher had to call Phillips instead of him, because he was in the lifeboat.
Yeah.
He was out of the picture all
right.
of a sudden.
Right.
But anyhow, I wasn't about to get underway because I got everything rigged up, you know, the technical stuff. I had to release the pawls back to aft. There's eight chains in the water, you know, eight anchors, every 45 degrees. And I was going to dump the four back aft and just take off, just rip the BOP and the riser and everything right out of the... But it would have been a horrible, horrible disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything started a fire... Yeah, those wildcats with a chain going over it would just be like lighting a cigarette lighter.
Giant torch.
And I didn't want to do that.
Right.
So I was giving that tool pusher all the time I could. And that was probably the most intelligent decision I ever made, was to ignore that company superintendent and everybody else who wanted to get the heck out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even want to... engines and the lifeboats lit off because they were hanging underneath the helicopter deck, you know, about 60 feet off the water. So anyhow, we finally got that blowout preventer to start to move, and it gently shut off.
Huh.
Instead of the mud blasting clear up into the crown block, the crown block was 160 feet up there off the drill floor.
Right. Right.
And when I went back aft to to disengage some pawls on the chain so I could flip the switch on the bridge and dump them,
Right. There
was at least an inch deep all the way back aft of this mud. And the closer you got to the derrick, the deeper the mud was. It got up about three inches deep, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing is, and you'd never expect this, but the color of it was a dark, like incandescent dark green, sparkling.
Is that right?
And that was because of the gas in there, that was liquefied gas came out with the mud and everything.
Yeah.
Because the pressure down there was about 16,000 pounds per square inch is what they drilled into. And that was blowing it up. They had registered 7,000 pounds per square inch on the choke and kill manifold on the drill floor.
Uh-huh.
This was big time.
Immense. That's immense.
And it was, but hey, there was no rust on that rig for a while. It was covered.
This turned out to be a great producer. Would have had to, right?
Oh yeah, it would have. All those, practically all those wells up there were real good.
Tremendous.
Because the geological work they did before, they would sample them and figure out where they wanted to put the production platforms. But the helicopter came out with a doctor, and by that time, all this green stuff had gone because all the enough of the gas had boiled out that it just left it a nice chocolatey mellow. But I didn't tell you that when the guy came in waving his arms to get underway, he looked exactly like the gingerbread man. You know, on his he looked like an animated gingerbread man. I had to laugh. I laughed and said, "I'm getting after it. I'll get her underway when I'm ready." Mm-hmm. And but then he came in after the it was all shut down and everything. He come roaring back in, saying, "Hold her, hold." Yeah, I'm holding him. But it took quite a while to get it shut down. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was the right decision to make. Mm-hmm. And this Bob Myers, the tool pusher, senior tool pusher, he's the one that saved the day. Because if he didn't know that blowout preventer like the back of his hand, he would have never been able to circumnavigate the problem that happened. There were some seals down there that were de-energized, and the hydraulic fluid flowed right out of the BOP into the sea.
Yes.
And he had to route some hydraulic fluid from something else in there and get it into those rams quick enough to get them shut.
Mm-hmm.
And but that worked out real good.
He knew what he was doing.
So, and they had to hire, six Mauritians from the Mauritius Islands and down in the Indian Ocean. And they had some people came up, six of them, and specifically to clean that rig. I mean, it was a massive job.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty nice guys, actually. I enjoyed working with them.
Okay,
then, after that, I got a job. They had a slowdown. They laid a lot of people off and stacked a lot of rigs. Towards the end, I was at 86.
Yes.
And I went to see for a company that had a contract with a defense mapping agency. And that was a large research ship. And I had a big, powerful helicopter on there. 16-man crew, including the three helicopter pilots, four survey boats, and I had a civilian crew of 50, and the Navy had a complement of about 175. About half a dozen of them were civil service.
Yeah.
And very interesting, primarily in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'd either work out of Singapore or Darwin, Australia, places like that.
Well, when we started this conversation, I mentioned, for the benefit of our audience, that you're a guy who's seen the world like nobody else I actually know. And I've seen a lot of it. You know that from my time in the Navy. You've been everywhere. You've done so many things that most people aren't even aware are happening in the world. You've had quite a life. I think Phyllis really made the right decision when she said, you do what you like to do, and you made that final decision to go become a mate with the Coast Guard. Your guys basically made choices in life that turned out to be great ones. And you had an extraordinary life. I think we are very fortunate that you decided, after all this was done, and it seemed like you took several times to retire from Global Marine, you end up coming back to Franklin, and you've become such a major part of the Franklin community. Everybody's active now with the Debents and places like that, the Kiwanis, that as you were when you were actually at sea. It's really, we're very fortunate to have you, Frank, and I think anybody in Franklin would say that anybody in the general oil region, up in Oil City, up in Titusville, you're just one of those guys. You did it. You were a doer. You did it, and it's a pleasure to hear your stories about all the things that happened. And I want to thank you for the community, from the standpoint of the community, for the life you've led, the fine family you've had, and for the fact that you've retired to this area and you've done so much for this area since you've come back. So I really want to thank you very, very much,
I want to thank my wife for putting up with me.
Yes.
At the end of this month, we're going to celebrate our 60th anniversary.
Is that right? Oh, yeah. That's great.
And she didn't even leave me when one day the phone rang here in 91.
Uh-huh.
And one of the my friend down in Houston, Texas, said they had a ship in the South China Sea and there was a super typhoon coming in. And they thought the captain was going to have a nervous breakdown. They wanted me to go out there. I said, no problem. They said, well, your ticket's in the Franklin Airport. So the next morning I went up there and flew over to the Philippines. And they met me at the airport and flew me out to some little island off the western coast and took a helicopter out, took command of that ship until after the typhoons had all gone, and I had to disconnect and move the ship. But she didn't even complain about that. She didn't know until after I got back why I left.
Why?
But I guess she was used to things like that.
Yeah.
But
you've told me the crew, when you arrived, the crew was very nervous on that ship. And they said, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I think you said something to the effect, we're heading south. Where? To the equator. There aren't any typhoons along the equator.
That's right.
Right? Wasn't that your scheme?
Well, we evacuated everybody that was non-essential, mm-hmm. except the chief steward and his gang. And he refused to go.
Uh-huh.
And so I had him come up and say, why aren't you or any of your people going? He said, anybody in their right mind knows that the safest place within 1,000 miles of here is wherever you're at, and I'm not leaving. He said, why would I want to go inland and get blown around when I know you're going where? He said, we got a lot of faith in you. He says, my gang's not leaving.
There you go.
So, right. But the rest of them do.
Well, we all have a lot of faith in you. We always have, and
This community is loaded with really nice people. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. And I appreciate all the people, and like you and your wife, and the whole organization with Oil 150, and the people in the Kiwanis Club, and the people that run the Debents Antique Music World, mm-hmm. and the Venango County Historical Society, and the churches. I mean, it's a great place to live.
Yes, it is.
I really enjoy it.
Well, we're very fortunate that you and Phyllis decided to stay here. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, believe me.
is this a cut?
That's a cut.
It's cut. That was wonderful. It worked out pretty well, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Do you have...